The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Sri Dayananda Das Goswami on April 13, 2008 in Columbus, Ohio.
In 1974, His Holiness was made member of the administrative body of ISKCON, where he was encumbered with the development of Krishna consciousness in Latin America. In the following 3 years, he established 25 centers of the society and attracted thousands of Latin Americans to Krishna consciousness. He is also the founder of the Portuguese and Spanish Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, which has distributed over 25 million books all over Latin America. Leaders of this thought, recognizing his profound devotional ambition, entrusted him to complete Srila Prabhupada's monumental translation and commentary of Srimad Bhagavatam. He is the first vessel to be trusted with this laborious task, and his success in communicating the essence of India's spiritual heritage has been noticed by scholars and religious leaders from the whole world. In 1996, His Holiness Srila Ananda Das Goswami received his PhD in Sanskrit and Indian studies from the University of Harvard. His present project is a translation and adaptation of Indian epic, the Mahabharata. He's also currently finishing his first novel, a modern-day exciting drama meant to captivate the general public by transmitting Krishna consciousness, philosophy, and values.
We'd like to wholeheartedly welcome His Holiness Srila Ananda Das Goswami.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Is there a Bhagavad Gita in the house? Oh, can I borrow that? Thank you. I'll give it back to you. So thank you all for coming to the celebration of Ram Navami, or Ram Navami, the appearance celebration of Lord Ramchandra. On this occasion, I was some ballroom dancing first, and then... So, can everyone please turn off your cell phones? Or turn the ringers off, or throw them in the punch bowl. So, I would like to read from the first part, first section of the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. This is Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation purports, of course, by Srila Prabhupada, because it is in this section of the Gita that we find what in Sanskrit would be called avatara katha, the description of the descent of Krishna into this world. And, of course, today we are celebrating such a descent, such an avatara of Krishna into this world. So, this section of the Gita, which I'm going to read, well, it goes for about 10 or 11 verses in the fourth chapter. So I'll begin, and I think I'll try to make clear to you the logic of it. Krishna is presenting here a logical description, and which, as you'll see, is quite relevant to the occasion. Krishna begins the fourth chapter by saying, well, Sri Bhagavanuvacha, the Lord said, Imam vivasate yogam proktavana hamabhyayam vivasan manave praha Manarik Swaka Vebravi. Does anyone here not know Sanskrit? Just kidding. Okay, so this means Krishna says that I spoke. It's more than spoke. It's like I declared or I taught this unperishing yoga. I'm going to give very literal translations, so to give you an idea of exactly what Krishna is saying in the Sanskrit, that I declared or I taught this unperishing abhigyam, unperishing yoga to Vibhaswan. Unperishing yoga. Here the word yoga, of course, does not refer to unperishing athletic club activities. Here it refers to the spiritual side of yoga. For example, I was giving the example the other day. Imagine if you go to some state-of-the-art movie theater. Movie theaters have to become more and more luxurious and attractive in order to, because of the fact that people tend to just, you know, rent or buy DVDs. But anyway, let's say you go to some movie theater and the seats are so nice and you're so interested in your seat and wow, you know, you can lean back and you can rock and it's comfortable and you actually forget to watch the movie. And then suddenly it's like the end, the credits are coming on, you realize that basically you were so absorbed in your seat you forgot to watch the movie. That's something like what's happening nowadays for many yoga practitioners. The yoga asanas, the different sitting postures and so on, that's what they are. They're just the seat, just to help you sit comfortably so you can watch the movie. The movie is the meditation on the Supreme Lord within your heart. And so if we do yoga and we get so much into our seat, our asana, and that's what the word asana means, seat, that we forget to watch the spiritual movie, of course there's no refunds, but we really missed the point. We've really missed the point. So when Krishna here says yoga, he's talking of, well, look at the word yoga. What is the word yoga? Sanskrit is an organic language, which means that it's you can study it in Whole Foods. Sanskrit is, I'm just joking, Sanskrit is an organic language in the sense that the ancient Sanskrit grammarians, who were literally thousands of years ahead of grammarians in other parts of the world, certainly in Europe, thousands of years ahead in terms of their penetration into the principles of phonetics, semantics, the morphology of language, and so on. They were thousands. In fact, what is now called linguistics, which you can study at universities like Ohio State and everywhere else, linguistics, this academic discipline of linguistics actually arose with the discovery of ancient Sanskrit grammar, because ancient Sanskrit grammar was so scientific. In any case, I'd be happy to talk to you all night about Sanskrit grammar, but it's not the occasion. So, it's an organic language in the sense that all words are analyzed first into roots, called dhatus. There are verbal roots, and then the words grow out of these roots. You have a root, then you have a stem, then you fiddle around like suffixes and prefixes, and you get a word. So there's a root. As for all other words in Sanskrit, there is a root for the word yoga. That's the point I wanted to make. And the root for the word yoga is yuj, y-u-j, which means to link, to connect. We still have traces of this word actually in English, in words like conjugal. So in the conjugal, the jug in conjugal, which means intimate connection. The jug is actually from the Sanskrit yug, from which you get the word yoga. Also words like yolk, not part of the yellow part of the egg, but yolk in the sense of something which connects a draft animal to a plow or something like that. So it's a yolk because it connects them, it links them. So these words, of course, are related or cognate with, historically related to Sanskrit. So the word yoga actually means to link, to connect. So what do you connect with what? What is being linked here? Basically, we who become the yogis or the feminine yogini, not yogini. Anyway, the yogi or the yogini, the man or woman that's practicing yoga, is connecting their own consciousness. Not their body. The body simply has to be made comfortable and healthy for the real practice. we are connecting our consciousness to the Supreme Consciousness, to the Infinite Consciousness. And that is actually yoga. A very good example is given actually in the Vishnu Purana, that Vishpulinga, just like a spark is part of a fire. So when the spark falls out of the fire, it goes out. Sparks are not, they can't do business on their own. They're dependent. As long as the spark is in the main fire, the spark is also fire or fiery. But when the spark falls out of the fire, it's extinguished. We are also sparks. By the way, Sanskrit word for fire is agni, as you know, from which we have the English word ignite. Kishra. Just a little interesting footnote. So anyway, when the spark falls out of the fire, it loses its fiery quality. Similarly, when we become disconnected from the Supreme Consciousness, our tiny consciousness, so to speak, goes out. I mean, we're still conscious, we're in this world, but the real happiness, ananda, the real knowledge, the real eternal existence, which are our nature. Our nature is to exist eternally, to basically know everything, to understand everything, and to have unlimited pleasure, unlimited spiritual pleasure. That is the nature of the soul. Those qualities have become covered because we have become disconnected. So the whole point of yoga is to reconnect oneself to God, to Krishna. By the way, that's what the word religion means, re ligare. Think of the word ligament, which sort of connects things. So re ligare in Latin means to reconnect. So the word religion and the word yoga actually originally have the same meaning. So that's the word Krishna is using here. Because the word yoga has become so common nowadays, I wanted to explain what it actually means, literally. So therefore, Krishna says, this unperishing yoga. Oh, we have an offending cell phone. Krishna says, this unperishing yoga, I spoke to Bhimaswan. In other words, the spiritual science. Prabhupada translates it here, science of yoga, because it's the spiritual science of how to connect yourself to God. And as soon as you connect yourself, you have unlimited pleasure, because Krishna, our God, is the source of all pleasure. Not simply the source of anger and punishment, but actually the source of pleasure. And so as soon as you're connected to Krishna, you have an unlimited, you can tap into an infinite reservoir of pleasure and knowledge and existence. So getting pleasure, getting knowledge, and getting permanent existence is not something we have to kind of fabricate ourselves. You simply have to connect to the source. You have to go to the source, and then there's unlimited pleasure, unlimited knowledge. That's stated, by the way, in the Vedas, Ramante Jogino Anante Satyanande Chidatme, and so on. The yogis enjoy this infinite pleasure, literally infinite pleasure within the Lord. Therefore, the Lord is called Rama. Actually, I'll quote this verse to you, since it is Ram Navami. Ramante, the verb Ram in Sanskrit, R-A-M, not the Caribbean beverage, but it's pronounced the same. The Sanskrit root Ram means to enjoy, or to find pleasure, to give pleasure. So, Ramante, yogino anante, the yogis, the spiritualists, find pleasure, enjoy, in the infinite, in the unlimited. Because it's not real bright, it's not very intelligent to seek pleasure in something which is limited. Because then you know, from the beginning, you're not going to be satisfied because you're trying to enjoy something which is limited. Like someone else's body, or a house made of stone and wood and cement. I mean, any way you slice it, stone and wood and cement don't give infinite pleasure. Although it may, anyway, especially when you have a bad mortgage. But, so this verse is, Ramante yogino anante. The yogis enjoy in the infinite. Ramante means they enjoy. Satyanande, they enjoy in the bliss of truth. Now, for example, if I'm trying to find happiness in false pride, self-centeredness, like I'm an important person, and I'm in a relationship in which I'm the center, you know, I'm very important, and you have to think that I'm very important. Any pleasure we have, which is based on vanity and self-centeredness, is actually not satya. It is not satya, it is not truth, it is mithya, it is false. In India, they say, as you know, satyam eva jayate, truth alone wins out. And so therefore, reality has this nasty habit of imposing itself. And so if we are trying to enjoy an illusion, like the illusion I'm the center, because we're not the center. I hope no one here will need grief counseling if you're hearing this. But actually, none of us are the center of reality. We can deal with that, right? None of us are the center of reality. And therefore, any self-centered attempt at happiness is actually an illusion. And therefore, it will be defeated by reality. Therefore, it says satyameva jayate. The truth alone wins out. So, it said that the yogis, the spiritualists, they enjoy in the bliss of truth. The truth is that we are tiny souls, that we are part of God or Krishna, Ram, and that we have an eternal loving relationship with Ram or Krishna, and it is in the act of engaging that relationship that we find infinite pleasure. That is satya. That is satya. And so the yogis enjoy in the bliss of that truth, not the illusion. They are satyanande. Chidatmani, in the bliss of truth, which is consciousness of the self, consciousness of the supreme soul and of ourselves. And therefore, iti rama padena so param brahma vidyate. Therefore, the param brahma, the absolute truth, the supreme spirit, is known as Rama. Iti Rama Pade, by the word Rama. Why? Because in Sanskrit, the word Rama, I'll do this, hopefully this will be very quick and painless, a little more Sanskrit grammar. If you're allergic to grammar, just take a deep breath. It'll be over very soon. But in Sanskrit, there's a certain verbal form called the causative in English grammar and grammatical terms, which means that it's a form of the verb which means to cause the action of the verb. For example, bhavati means he, she, it, or it exists. But bhavyati means to cause someone or something to exist. Or karoti means he, she, or it does. But karyati means to cause someone or something to do something. And so Rama, the long A in Rama, is actually indicates the causative, ramyati, which means to cause pleasure, to be the source of pleasure. So the word Rama actually means a source of pleasure. The source of pleasure. And that's why the absolute truth is called Rama, because the spiritualists find infinite pleasure in him, in Rama. Actually, Sita Ram. There's a feminine aspect also. The nice thing about this Vedic culture is that there's balance, gender balance, you could say. There's the female and the male. So, see, in fact, it's ladies first. Sita Ram. Sita Ram. Sita is the feminine aspect of the Absolute Truth, and Ram is the masculine aspect. And the world would be very dull indeed if everyone was one gender, right? It would be a very strange world, to say the least. So, the fact that we have two genders in this world, actually, originally, because the Vedanta says, janmadyasya jataha, the absolute truth is the source of everything. So that means gender comes from the absolute truth. And there is male and female in this world precisely because they exist in the absolute truth. So in the absolute truth, there is male and female also. Therefore, we have Sita Ram. So Krishna says, I spoke this unperishing yoga to Vibhasan. Now, Vibhasan is the CEO of the sun, the shiny thing. The idea is that everything has a CEO or someone that's in charge of it. For example, we're in this building right now and we don't see anyone managing this building. But the fact that the lights, well, yeah, the lights are on, and the building's clean, and the windows have been cleaned and everything, they're all these symptoms of administration. We can tell just by looking at the building, it's somewhat... Now, if a building's abandoned for a long time, it doesn't look like this. It doesn't look like this. So therefore, even though we can't see the managers, the regularity of it, the functionality of it indicates that actually someone manages it. In the same way, someone manages the universe. Well, actually, a bunch of people manage the universe. It's a large corporation. So, it's actually, you could think of it as a cause. Maybe the child could be taken to the back of the room so that if the child erupts, you could just sort of step out there. So, you could think of the universe as a cosmic corporation, and someone manages it, even if you can't see that person. So, that person is Vivaswan. Now, the fact that Krishna here says that he speaks to Vivaswan means that he's already inside the universe. This is already an inside job. It's like God is transcendental. God is beyond the universe. What's he doing inside the universe? But he's already inside. When Krishna says, of course, he's inside speaking to Arjuna. Not to speak of Krishna speaking to Vivaswan, the leader of the sun, Krishna's already speaking to Arjuna. So he's already descended. Krishna's already descended. And he says that Vivaswan heard from me. Vivaswan Manavepraha spoke to Manu. Manu Rikshvaka Vebravi. And Manu spoke to Rikshvaku. So Vivaswan received this knowledge, spoke to his son, Manu. Manu spoke to his son, Ikshvaku. And it came to the earth. Krishna is explaining how this spiritual science came from higher planets, you could say celestial planets, and how this knowledge descended to the earth. Because Ikshvaku is known as a Homa Raja, an earthly king. So that's what Krishna is explaining. That first of all, before he describes how he comes to the earth, he explains the knowledge comes to the earth. So the knowledge itself, it's like the Gita avatar. The knowledge itself descends to the earth. Now, having described this teaching, Krishna then says, evam parampara praptam imam raja shayobidu. The rajarshis, which means the saintly king, the king sages, or the sage kings, or your choice. Anyway, these great personalities who were sages and kings understood this spiritual science, or they understood the spiritual science as it was received, praptam, as it was received through parampara. The word parampara means a succession, which Krishna has just explained. I spoke to Vivaswan, Vivaswan spoke to Manu, Manu spoke to Ikshvaku, then Krishna says, evam, thus, this is how it works. It is a parampara, it is a succession, and that's how the knowledge is transmitted. But something went wrong, as it always does in this world. Then Krishna says, Sakali Neha Mahata Yoga Nashta Parantapa. That by Mahakala, by great time, which means a lot of time, a long period of time, or powerful time, this yoga, this spiritual science was lost. Here we have, so even knowledge is subject to the law of atrophy. In other words, you take anything in this world, like this building, and just leave it alone, it will basically disintegrate over a certain period of time. Scientists talk about the half-life of this or that. And everything has a half-life, I guess, except plastic cups. Anyway, Krishna will say in chapter 11 of the Gita, when Arjuna, when he displays his cosmic form, Vishwarupa, and Arjuna says, who are you? Kobalan. Ugra Rupa, and Krishna will say, Kalos me Lokachakra, time I am, destroyer of the world. So time is not merely a medium through which events pass, like the space-time continuum. Time is not merely a medium. It is the power that drives things through itself. This is a very important insight in the Vedic culture. The word for time is Kala. And this is there's a verb, Sanskrit verb kal, kaliti, which means to impel, to drive forward. And therefore, the fact that, let's say, our bodies are aging, is anyone, there's no one in this room who can call time out for 1 second. Try it. I mean, it's like a game where you get no time out. The clock keeps ticking. It's like once you get into the cosmic octagon, you know, it's ultimate struggle for existence. There are no timeouts. It's a game with no timeouts. So you may be the most powerful person in the world, the richest person in the world. Try calling time out for 1 second. So that for 1 second your body stops aging. So there is a power. The reason our bodies are aging is not merely as a, you know, as a conspiracy to keep the cosmetic industry going. Although I'm sure there's a website arguing that it is a conspiracy, the Trilateral Commission, to keep the cosmetic industry going. There must be a conspiracy website. But actually, you'll be glad to hear this is not one of those conspiracies. In this case, the reason everything is aging and deteriorating in time is simply because something is driving us. You can say it's natural, just like take the law of gravity. Newton, of course, is famous for explaining the law of gravity, among other things he explained. By the way, when Newton was asked at the end of his life what he thought his most important achievement was in life, he said that he was a Naishika Brahmachari, that he was a lifelong celibate. Which in this age is probably more difficult than discovering the laws of physics. Anyway, so Newton explained or described the law of gravity, but as far as why should mass exert gravity, no one knows. It just does. So in the same way, there is a reason. It doesn't just do that. So why do our bodies age? Because time is not merely a medium through which events take place. It is the power that forces events in a certain direction, with a certain vector. Namely, it forces them into deterioration. And that's what Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita. So, therefore, when Krishna says, by great time, this yoga was lost, spiritual science was lost, that's consistent with what time is. Then Krishna says, so that was the bad news, but there's good news. The bad news is the yoga was lost. The good news is Krishna found it. So Krishna says here, Nekra Saivayam Mayatevya Yoga Prokta Puratana. That literally that very same primordial or primeval or ancient, the very same ancient yoga today I have declared to you. The very same yoga, Saivayam, the very same yoga. Why? Why to Arjuna? And why didn't Krishna go to the, I don't know, speak to a Brahmin? After all, in that Vedic, highly specialized, sophisticated Vedic culture which existed back then, knowledge was basically the business, or the vocation, let us say, the vocation of the Brahmins. The Brahmins were the teachers. Why did Krishna speak to Arjuna? Because, who was a warrior? Because Krishna wanted to make a point that this is a special knowledge, the best knowledge, which has special qualifications to understand it. And therefore Krishna says to Arjuna, Bhakto si, you are devoted to me, or you are my devotee. Sakha, you are my friend. Iti cheti rahasyam yedu uttamam. Therefore, it is you that can understand this highest spirit, this highest, most advanced knowledge. Krishna will, anyway, so I want to go on here. I mean, this is common sense. Unless you're really emotionally not doing well and, I don't know, somehow couldn't find your meds. No normal, healthy person goes out on the street up to strangers and starts telling them all the intimate secrets of their life. Although in America, you have to stop some people. But generally, we reveal the intimate secrets of our life to people we trust, to people who we know love us. If you know that someone actually loves you and will always do what's best for you, then you can trust that person. So Krishna says that I reveal myself to those who love me. That's not a religious dogma, it's just common sense. Therefore, if we want to know Krishna, or Ram was also Krishna, we have to be devoted. So then, I want to get to the avatar part. Krishna said, now, Arjuna has a question about this. You could say, this is all well and good. Krishna has revealed this extraordinary information that he initiated the teaching of the spiritual science. It was passed down. It came to the earth. That Arjuna has been selected to hear the spiritual knowledge because he is devoted to Krishna. So, what's the problem? But Arjuna has a problem. Arjuna thinks he's found some inconsistency in Krishna's story. So Arjuna says, that's his job here, otherwise we wouldn't have his Gita. So Arjuna Vacha, aparam bhavato janma, param janma vivasata. He said that Vivaswan, the son, CEO, is, his birth is before yours. You were born after him. So, Katameta Bijaniya, how can I understand this? How can I understand this that Twamadao Prabhu Divine, in the beginning you spoke to him? When he existed millions of years before your appearance now on earth. And what's implicit here, what's understood here, is that Vivasan has possessed this spiritual knowledge for millions of years. In other words, it's not that the person ruling the sun was basically ignorant until very recently. So, Vivasan had this knowledge, he's had it for millions of years, you're my age, Krishna. Krishna and Arjuna were the same age, so how can I understand that you spoke to him? That's the question. Now, this question is important because Arjuna is really focusing now this conversation with Krishna, what's called later Samvada, this dialogue, this conversation. Arjuna is focusing this conversation on the nature of Krishna's descent into this world. So now we're going to get the avatara katha, the story, the explanation of Krishna's descent. So then, so what does Krishna say? Krishna said, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Bahuni mevyati dani janmani tavacharjuna. Arjuna, I have taken many births, you also. We have come into this world many times in the past. Tanyaham veda sarvani, Krishna says, I know all of these births. I know them all. Natam veda parantapa, you don't know them. Arjuna. So this verse is taken by the Vaishnavacharya as a very important statement by Krishna. Krishna is making a distinction between himself and Arjuna. He doesn't tell Arjuna, you don't know all of our past births because you were never hypnotically regressed or like I was, or you don't know all of our past births because I'm smart and you're dumb. It's nothing like that. Arjuna was a very brilliant person, extremely intelligent, so Krishna conscious, so spiritually advanced that Krishna is speaking the Gita to him. So the reason that Krishna knows all these births, such as his birth is wrong, and Arjuna doesn't, is because Krishna is God and Arjuna isn't, which is a significant difference. Krishna is God and Arjuna isn't. So then Krishna says, Ajovisa, even though I'm actually unborn. Now we're going to get some paradoxical language. Paradox should not be confused with a contradiction. A contradiction occurs when two statements simply cancel each other out. They can't both be true in the same relevant way. Whereas a paradox is an apparent contradiction. Things appear to be contradictory. Now, paradoxes are intentionally used frequently, actually, in spiritual literature. Jesus used paradoxes. Krishna uses paradoxes. Why? Why use paradoxes? Because it forces you to stop speed reading, basically. can't, you know, try out all your, you know, your speed reading tricks. In other words, you can't stay on the surface. You can't stay on the surface of the text, just sort of skimming along, you know, sort of hydroplaning the Gita. A paradox is there. A paradox is a philosophical speed bump. That's the way to understand it. Paradox is a philosophical speed bump. Makes you slow down and think, well, what is this anyway? And that's what Krishna's doing. Krishna just put in a philosophical speed bump in the text. So Krishna says, Ajopi son, even though I am unborn, and Bhutanam Isharopi son, and even though I am the Lord of all creatures, still, Prakriting Swam Adishtaya, literally standing over, in other words, utilizing from a superior position, Adishtaya, standing over, utilizing my own nature, my own energy, Sambhavami, I arise, I appear in this world, Atma Maya, by my own power. Now, we did not take birth in this world in our own power. It's not that, you know, we, in our previous life, went to a website, you choose your next body, and then we selected and clicked, yeah, I think I want to look like that. Yeah, I'll take that family. Because if it were true, everyone would have been, or most people would have been born in very, very rich families. Most, almost everyone would be very beautiful. No one would need cosmetic surgery. Where I come from, actually, in Southern California, it is a big chunk of the Yellow Pages, cosmetic surgery. It's one of the real economic engines of Southern California. But anyway, so as you know, all of us have taken birth in different families, in different economic situations, with different, and I don't think anyone can say that that there's absolutely nothing I would want for my body or my birth that I don't have. I mean, if we really had the freedom to sort of do a little, you know, digital nose job on ourselves, or maybe a little more income for our family, or maybe I would have been born in a place with better weather. I mean, the fact is that it's not by our own power that we take birth. It's not by our own power that our bodies aren't floating up into the ceiling. It's by the law of gravity. It's not by our own power that we're aging and we're getting older and we will leave this world. So it's very, very obvious that we are very much under a higher power. You can call it the laws of nature. You can call it the laws of the principles of psychology. You can call whatever you want, but the fact is there. You can stick any name you want, physical, metaphysical, mystical, put any name you want on it, the fact, which you cannot avoid, is that we are all under a higher power. Call it what you want. We are under a higher power. And Krishna is here distinguishing himself from our situation, as you distinguish yourself from Arjuna's situation. Now, when he says, even though I'm the Lord, so why is this so amazing? Why does Krishna twice, in each of the first two lines of this sloka, this verse, why does he use the Sanskrit word api, which means even though? When you say even though, you're saying something which may surprise people, like, for example, even though I'm sitting in this chair, right now I'm actually in Cleveland. And this is an extremely sophisticated hologram. So, we use words like even though when we are saying something which seems like it shouldn't be that way. So why does Krishna twice use the word api, even though? Because, well, why? Well, first of all, he says, Ajopi, even though I'm actually unborn. I'm actually unborn. And so you find these paradoxical statements in the Bhagavatam, such as Ajojata, the unborn has taken birth. Because even though Krishna apparently, God apparently takes birth as a human being, he's not a human being, and he's not taking birth in the same biological way that we do. Was that a signal? And then Krishna says, although, again, or even though, even though I'm the Ishwara of all creatures. Now, why does Krishna say, even though I'm the Ishwara of creatures, which means the Lord? First of all, we have to remember that the word Ishwara is sort of like Sanskrit philosophical jargon. This is the word for God used in the Yoga Sutras. This is the word used for the Lord or God in many ancient Sanskrit texts. And there was a conception among certain people, just as there is nowadays, that the Lord or God does not really directly participate in human history. In fact, take modern scientists. Interestingly, about 50% or more of scientists today actually believe in God. But then if you ask, how many of you believe in a God who actually alters, or how should I put it, affects, influences the laws of physics as we know them? There's a tendency for educated people to go for a type of deistic theology. Deism was when Europe started to have its scientific revolution and rational revolution, there was sort of like, some people sort of couldn't go with what they considered to be a mythological depiction of God, and so they chose deism, which was a philosophy that God, it's almost Aristotelian. For Aristotle, God is the unmoved mover. For Aristotle, everything that exists exists in a very logical way. They're logical causal chains which explain everything. Everything cognitive and everything physical. And so God is the first mover. Because if not, A is the cause of B, but what is the cause of A? So the idea is that to avoid an infinite regress of causes, if you say, like Vedanta addresses the issue of what is the origin of everything. Vedanta addresses the issue of what is the origin of everything. And if you just posit an infinite regress, there's no origin. There is no ultimate truth. It's just an infinite regress. And therefore, Aristotle says that in order to actually explain, you have to accept that there's an unmoved mover. There is a supreme being, God, that moves things, but is self-moved. Nothing outside God has to move God. God is the unmoved mover. Or to use the Sanskrit term, sarva karana karana, the cause of all causes. Ishwara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadiradya Govinda. That Govinda is the origin, the Adi of everything, but has no origin. Because Krishna is sarva karana karana, the cause of all causes, and himself uncaused. So many people believe that, especially sometimes educated people who feel they have intellectually outgrown stories about personal gods, they feel that, okay, maybe there's a God, but that God is Aristotle's unmoved mover, or simply the Lord, someone who starts causal chains and then doesn't interfere with them, kind of steps out of the way and finds some other way to amuse himself. So, therefore, Krishna is saying, and this idea existed thousands of years ago in India, it still exists today, it's very popular among people that believe themselves to be intellectual, but pious at the same time. In fact, you find this in the Bhagavatam. For example, when Kamsa was worried that Vishnu was coming to kill him again, Kamsa and Krishna Lila, his ministers, who were obviously not the best and the brightest, his ministers told him, don't worry, because actually Vishnu is in the hearts of all creatures and he can't come out. Many people feel this. It's a very popular idea nowadays, New Age idea. There's a lot of people are pious enough to want a god, but not pious enough to want him to actually show up at your party. Because, you know, you want to have fun at your party and you don't want God showing up and kind of ruining it. It's like, you're young, you're having a party at college, you don't want your parents showing up at your party. It's like, hi mom, hi dad, what are you doing here? And so, that's the idea. People want, I want to know that my father and mother love me. I don't want them to show up at my party. So, that's basically one philosophy. That yes, there is a God, but he just, you know, God's in heaven and we're down here and we love each other and let's just, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. So therefore, what Krishna is saying here is that even though I am the Lord, even though I am the Lord, I actually come down and I actually am going to crash your party. So put the liquor away. Anyway, that's what Krishna is saying here. Even though I'm the Lord, I show up. Now, then he says, and this is a famous verse which most people, most Hindus know, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutthanam adharmasya tadatmanam sajamyam. Whenever. Yada means when. Yada yada means whenever. Whenever, Krishna says, dharma is collapsing. Dharmasya glanir. For example, if, let's say, in some part of a city, law and order is collapsing, I suppose the police selectively may actually go there and do something about it, if it's a part of the city where law and order is not supposed to collapse. So, I mean, this is just natural. If you're the governor or the mayor or in charge of some human community, and law, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, you can't be here right now. Thank you. See, law and order. So, Krishna is the supreme governor. He says in Bhagavad Gita, Maya Dhyakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam, by my literally supervision, Adhyaksha, or oversight, Adhyaksha, by my supervision, nature is functioning. Krishna is the supreme governor, so it's natural. Krishna is saying here what any responsible governor would say, when law and order collapses, I come and reestablish it. Krishna is setting the example for any responsible leader. Now, if you do in your family, if you're out with your kids and the kids are starting to go wild, you have to, you know, you have to discipline them. Or, I guess nowadays, what parents do in this country is you blame everyone else. You blame all the people your children are harassing. Anyway, American culture. So, the idea is when your children are misbehaving, you have to put your foot down. You have to discipline them. If you own a company and your employees are getting out of control, you have to do something about it. This is very simple stuff. So Krishna is saying, dharma. Dharma means law. It means the codes by which civilization functions. So when this starts to collapse, Krishna comes. And when adharma, which means chaos, is strongly rising, then Krishna says, at that time I manifest myself, and what does Krishna do? Parichanaya sadhunam. He delivers, he saves good people, vinashaya duskritam. He removes bad people. You know, they're out of the game. Vinashaya duskritam. And dharma sangstapanataya, and he reestablishes dharma. He reestablishes the principles by which the universe functions, by which civilization functions. And he does this, he says, in every age, sabhavami yuge. And then Krishna says, and then we'll get to Ram. I mean, because we are talking about Ram, this is all about Rama. Krishna says, janma karma chame divyam evam yoveti tatvataha. Anyone who thus understands my divine birth and activities. Divya janma, divya karma. And Krishna says you have to understand it tatvataha. In truth. And I'll explain this word in a second. Krishna says, but if you understand Krishna's divine appearance as Rama, as Lakshman, and so on, or as his associate, Sita, Hanuman, if you understand these things, then you win the grand prize. Yatva deham punar janma naiti, mam iti sorjana, giving up this body, you will not take another birth in this world, a birth and death, but Krishna says, you will come to me. You will come to me. Back to home, back to God. Now, if you know what this world is and what the spiritual world is, you understand. Well, I guess it's a gray area, isn't it? Hare Krishna, why don't you just, maybe you can sit there, and then when I'm done, you can pass it around, okay? Nice try. So, nice idea, just So we'll just wrap it up here. So Krishna says you have to understand him tattvataha. Why does Krishna say you have to understand his birth tattvataha? Is that hot? You want to put that down? Is it? It's not too hot for you? Okay. You're getting the mercy from Krishna. So, why does Krishna say you have to understand? What does the word tattva mean? Because tattvataha means you have to understand Rama. Let's take Rama. You have to understand Rama tattvataha. What does it mean to understand Rama tattvataha? So let's talk about the word tattva, because that's the key to understanding Rama properly, Ramchandra properly. The word tat in Sanskrit. The word tat in Sanskrit is in English. You add an H, it's English, that. It's a demonstrative pronoun, and therefore it points out a real thing that exists in the world. And twa in Sanskrit, tattva, means existing as tat. Tattva, existing as tat. So tattva in Sanskrit comes to mean a fundamental real thing that exists in the world. It is a Sanskrit word for a fundamental category. A fundamental real thing is tattva. Now, there are many tattvas, but ultimately there are three most important, most basic tattvas, and every other tattva is one of these three. This is called tattva-traya. The three tattvas. What are the fundamental real things that actually exist and that can be pointed out? They are Vishnu tattva, God. God is a category of real things. In other words, there is Rama, there's Krishna, there is Narayan. These are all the same supreme God, but appearing in different ways. So therefore, God, Vishnu, is a tattva. It's a fundamental real thing, irreducible real thing, God. Then there is Prakriti Tattva. There is nature, dead matter, which is a fundamental real thing. And finally there is Jiva Tattva, the individual soul, ourselves, the living being, as a fundamental real thing. And to understand Ramchandra Tattvataha means, for example, not to think that Rama, that sharira, that rupa, that deha, body, that the form of Ram, it is not Prakriti Tattva, it is directly Vishnu Tattva. In other words, it is not that there is some God who comes and sort of puts on this Ram costume and zips it up and does things in the world. Actually, that's a very popular misunderstanding. A couple years ago, I gave a lecture at the largest Hindu temple in the Knoxville, Tennessee area. We're in Ohio now. You travel so much, you have to remember what state you're in. Anyway, so in the back of the temple, they had this large color poster to help educate the congregation. Explain, you know, who it said, who is who in Hinduism? Who is who in Hinduism? And basically, the idea it gave was that there is an Ishwara, there is a Lord, and that Lord appears in different ways, temporarily, like as, you know, Ram or Krishna or Shiva or this or that or whatever, but the real God is simply the generic Ishwara. Now, according to Vedic knowledge, there is no generic Ishwara. You can say Ram is Ishwara, Ram is the Lord. Krishna is certainly Ishwara, and in his own way, for example, Shiva is Maheshwara, a great lord. So, but there's no generic Ishwara who's not Shiva or Ram or Krishna or anyone. It's just Ishwara. A faceless, nameless, activityless, generic Ishwara. That's not actually what the Krishna teaches. That's not actually what Vedic knowledge teaches. For example, let's say we talk about the governor, and you say, well, who's the governor? Well, no. Any particular person is just a representative of the governor. Well, who's the governor? The governor has no name. The governor has no face, but every person you think is a governor, every person that has a name and a face is really just representing the governor. I mean, I hope you're all having a realization that this is pretty silly. So the idea that Krishna or Rama are representing a generic Ishwara who has no name or face or lila is it's equally silly. It's equally silly. So, therefore, Rama, that Ram Sarita, the form of Ram, is spiritual. It's adhyatmika. It's divya. It is not prakrita. It is not material. And to understand this, to know that the Ram Sarita is actually divya, Ram's body is actually spiritual, is to understand Rama tatvataha, to get the tatvas lined up. You have to line up, if you want to actually get moksha and understand God, you have to line up your theological duckies, so to speak. And you've got to get these, you've got to line up the tatvas. It's like in Las Vegas. You know, you line up the blueberries and you get a lot of money. So just like in Las Vegas, you have to line up, you know, cherries or blueberries or strawberries, whatever. In Krishna consciousness, in Vedic culture, you have to line up the tattvas. If you line up the tattvas, you know, then you collect. And that's what Krishna is saying here. So to line up the tattvas means you have to understand that Ram is spiritual, his body is spiritual, Lakshman, Hanuman, Sita, these are not material forms, they're spiritual. Sita, her very name, furrow, she was born out of a furrow in the field, isn't it? I mean, she wasn't born at the local hospital. We have to think about these things. So, lining up the tattvas means to understand the spiritual form of Ram, and not to mistake him for an ordinary human being. And if you understand that way, then you're liberated. So finally, in the few hours remaining to me, I'm just kidding, don't panic. The last few minutes, of course, I want to speak about Ram. Ram is an extremely relevant avatar. An extremely relevant, important appearance of God in this world, Krishna. Because back then, of course, there was a problem with, the terrorist of the time was Ravana. And so Ravana, if you analyze him, I mean, you think of, in some ways he was actually doing a good job. If you were on his side, it's like the mafia. You know, if you're a friend, then you can get whatever you want. If you're not a friend, then, you know, you end up, what do they say, with a pair of, like, lead shoes, you know, at the bottom of the river? So if you cooperate, like Ravana, like the mafia, that famous line from The Godfather, you know, Ravana would always make people offers they couldn't refuse. But if you think about Ravana, like, what was basically wrong with him, especially in the act which ultimately caused his destruction? He wanted to enjoy Lakshmi without the permission of Ram. I mean, in the sense that he could have enjoyed Lakshmi by serving Sita Ram, gotten her blessings. That's the civilized way to enjoy Lakshmi, is to serve Lakshmi, and then she will give her blessings. And Sita, of course, is Lakshmi. But Ravana thought he could take Lakshmi without serving her husband, without Ram. So trying to enjoy a woman without her husband is not the way to go. And imagine, in this case, the husband is Narayana, is God. So consider the modern world. What is consumerism if not the attempt to enjoy Lakshmi without Narayana? That's what the whole world is nowadays. Everyone wants to enjoy Lakshmi, wealth, fortune, without Narayana. So therefore, nowadays, you know, back then there was, so long ago there was one Maharavana. Now we have so many little Ravanitos. Now the world is filled with little micro-Ravanas, little junior Ravanas. But it's the same program, it's the same concept, that I will enjoy fortune, because after all, fortune, it's all belongs to God. So everyone is trying to enjoy Lakshmi, fortune, but without her husband Narayana. What else would you call secularism? So, Anyway, secularism, that's a whole other topic, like what form of government we should have. We're not advocating a banana republic theocracy. But still, the way it has been set up nowadays, the whole world is just a reenactment of the Ramayana, but on a Kali Yuga level, you know, sort of little in miniature. So, why is Hanuman the Parama Ram Bhakta? Why is Hanuman the greatest devotee of Ram? Hanuman, the greatest devotee of Ram? Because he helped Ram bring back Lakshmi to her husband. That was a service. So, we should follow the example of Hanuman. Krishna is more pleased when you serve his devotee. And so if we follow the example of Hanuman, we can actually approach Ram. Because, and Lakshman, I mean, you consider who could actually approach Ram, who could actually understand Ram, who actually developed a powerful relationship with Ram. Sita, Lakshman, Hanuman, all those who dedicated their lives to Ram's mission. So therefore, if we want to have a powerful relationship with Ram, we actually want to know him. We want him to really pay attention to us. We have to follow the example of Hanuman, of Sita, of Lakshman, and others. So just as long, long ago, Ram had his mission, there's still a mission, and Krishna just explained his mission. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashayacha duskritam dharma sangstapana. Dharma sangstapana, to re-establish, to powerfully establish dharma, the actual principles of life by which civilized human beings should live for their own happiness, is always Krishna's mission. And so we need to take advantage of this occasion, Ram Navami, Ram Naomi, to dedicate or rededicate ourselves to following the example of these great souls and dedicating ourselves to the Lord's mission on earth. That's the real meaning of this day. And of course, fortunately, there's a Sankirtan movement. Ram, or Krishna, has personally come as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We have the Sankirtan mission. And so by serving this movement to spread the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, we are directly following the footsteps of Hanuman, or Sita, or Lakshman. We are serving, in our own little junior way, we are directly serving the Lord's mission as they did, and following their example. The highest form of honor or puja is to follow. What Krishna really needs, what Ram really needs, is not, I mean, it's nice, of course we offer lamb, we should offer the lamb, but to be honest, it's not that Krishna really needs a lamp. Krishna is letting us offer that for our own purification so that we can learn Krishna accepts our offering. So we need to make that offering. But ultimately, the real offering... By the way, what I just said is as they say, don't kill the messenger. What I just said is coming right from the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, Shayan Dravyamayat Yagya Jnana Yagya Tat Parantapa. Better than an offering of a material object, dravya, which means a lamp, incense, water, even food. We do make those offerings. I'm not saying that we're not going to offer it. But Krishna says, there is another offering which is even better. That's what Krishna says. Shreyan, dravya mayat yagya, jnana yagya parantapa. It is the offering of your consciousness. I can offer a lamp to Krishna or water, and I can have my own opinion and not even agree with Krishna. Or not even care what Krishna thinks. It's just sort of like, okay, there's something we should do. My grandmother did it. Or, you know, I'm going to do it to save my neck. Or whatever. Or it's just the right... And we can do it with many different attitudes. But Krishna says in the Gita, Chaturvidha Vajante Ma Jana Sukriti No Arjuna. Four kinds of people worship me, but the one who actually understands me is the best. The one who actually understands me. Well, you did a great job. Thank you very much. Here. We'll give you a feast later, okay? You did a good job. So, Krishna says that the four kinds of people who approach me, the best is the one who actually has knowledge of me, the jnani. And then he says, better than just offering me material things, offer me knowledge, offer me your consciousness, agree with me. See the world as I see it, because I made the world. Just like today on the way into this program, I stopped at the Apple store, because sannyasis regularly visit Apple stores to get their state-of-the-art computers checked. And so, anyway, the reason I went to the Apple store is because they made it. So you figure, well, they made it. They must know how it works. So Krishna made the world. It's like they say, if everything else fails, read the directions. So Krishna made the world. The world comes with a manual. You know, the Bhagavad Gita is like, you know, it's like the universe for dummies. So Krishna is explaining that better than simply offering me material things, offer me your consciousness. Now, and Krishna says here that I come to this world to establish dharma, to save the good people. So if we follow Krishna, we should come to this world for the same reason. We should be in the world for the same reason that Krishna's in the world. That's the whole point. That's why Hanuman is Hanuman. That's why we remember him. Because he was in the world for the same reason Ram was in the world. And the same was true for Sita and Lakshman. That is real Vaidika Dharma. That is the Vedic culture. So, stop here. Any questions on these points? Yes. Gravity, yes. Gravitas.
Shiksha.
What do you mean? What is the word? Shesha. Oh, Shesha. Well, it's Krishna's power. By the word, by the way, gravity, gravitas, is related to the Sanskrit word Gautama. Same word. Gravity in Sanskrit is Gautama. Anyway, go ahead. So what's your question? Oh, I'm sure they would be very eager to adopt that.
Thank you.
I guess that. I don't think the scientists really, I mean, at this point, I don't think any of them would be interested in Shesha, Ananta Shesha. But still, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Maya Yakshena Prakriti, it's actually by my supervision the world is functioning. So of course, Shesha is also there, but ultimately, I think for scientists, the basic point is that it is by the supervision of God that the world goes on. I mean, I think we should focus on that rather than a particular detail, which is beyond their investigation. Yes?
Thank you very much for a nice question.
Maharaj said that Krishna is not really interested, but
what Krishna says is, I mean, obviously we should offer the arti, we should offer the puja. But Krishna says there's something even more important than that. I'm saying it is necessary, but not sufficient. The most important thing Krishna says is offer me your consciousness. Agree with me. See the world as I see it.
Is arti generally a medium to offer
it? Of course it is. If you perform arti in a mood of submission to Krishna, that's very good. But if you want to know what Krishna thinks, you have to read the Bhagavad Gita. Unless you're so fortunate, the deity is speaking to you. Krishna spoke in Bhagavad Gita, and so we should learn what Krishna said. Both by studying Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and also by hearing from those who know it. But of course, arti should be, when you perform arti, or when you perform puja, as an expression of what you know to be true about God, then it's very powerful. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Ashadhaya, Bhutang, Dattang, Tapastattang, and so on. If you, whatever you offer, or whatever you give in charity, if it's done without faith, in other words, without really knowing what you're doing, Krishna is asat. If you don't get, I mean, there's some benefit, of course, but you don't get the full benefit.
So is it one way or the other, like wait for the knowledge to come before you start the activity, or the activity will gradually develop knowledge? Or
the knowledge is here, I mean, the knowledge is immediately available.
Right.
The knowledge is right here. There's nothing to wait for.
Right. But you're saying activity.
No, you don't have to wait. I mean, the knowledge is here, just you can begin anywhere. Right. I mean, it doesn't matter if you do the puja, if you go to the puja now and 10 minutes later you get a Gita. I mean, it's not like, the point is if you come here and if you simply want to understand, if you simply participate with a desire to understand, being open-minded, then that's also the proper attitude. It's not like, you know, God is not like a gotcha deity where, okay, technically you're off sides here, you do the puja, but you haven't read this verse, therefore, you know, all the way back, 15 yards, loss of puja. It's not a technical, like a booby-trapped little game. It's just common sense. The good news is, God has common sense, even if sometimes the priests don't. So, the idea is that Krishna wants to see your intention. If your heart's in the right place, then you'll pass. So, anything else? If not, was there anything else back there? Yes. I suppose we can arrange something. You'll have to feed me, though. Yeah, we'll work it out. Yes, back there. Oh, that's your Gita. Okay. Yeah, I'll leave it here for you.
The act of loving God, Krishna in this case, so vipassana, which is the truth of the consciousness being of ourselves, the Supreme Spirit, is enjoyment to be exist, the cause of existence to enjoy the love of God, the absolute truth, is there a balance between the opposite forces of love, Krishna?
Is there a balance between?
Yeah, more or less, I believe that there's a balance between the opposite forces of this world without being able to put a negative or a positive force on this. Negative sounds negative.
That balance with what else? I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
The supreme nature of existence.
Yes. Yeah, the supreme nature of existence is Krishna.
Right. And you bring to us balance to understand that?
Yes. Because we're part of Krishna, we're part of God.
So as long as we love and see God, then we
oh, completely. It's like, I mean, imagine, for example, if you live, let's say, on the coast of one of the Great Lakes, you're not going to run out of water because there's a lot of water there. So the whole point of yoga is you connect. Yoga means you connect yourself to the infinite pleasure, the infinite consciousness, and therefore, by that connection, that link, you have an infinite source of happiness and knowledge. And the nature of the connection is love. Because, you know, it's not, in other words, our relationship to God is not merely magnetic or we're stapled together physically or something. I mean, if you think of it, what is the connection? It's not electrical, it's love. Love is the most powerful connection. When two people truly love each other, they're inseparable. Even if physically they're separated, they're actually inseparable. And so the relationship between ourselves and God is love. And therefore, bhakti yoga is not only, according to Krishna's explicit statement at the end of chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita, not only the highest form of yoga, as Krishna explicitly says there, but it is a description of our eternal life. It is yoga, a link to God, bhakti through love and devotion. So bhakti yoga is not only the means, it is the end. It is the ultimate state of the soul. And in that state, you'll never want for anything. How could you? I mean, let's say if you had a very loving father and mother who actually loved you, and they were trillionaires, you would always have enough t-shirts. What's that? Right. But I'm saying that, true, and you're very fortunate for that. But I'm saying if, let's say, we have loving parents that are trillionaires, I mean, in terms of actual numbers, like money, then, obviously, I mean, so Krishna, God, Krishna knows everything. So if we reestablish our proper relationship with God, then how could we ever lack for anything? Maybe we'll stop here and go on to the Kirtan.
We will have Kirtan and Krishna. For this question and answers, Maharaj will be the production during the feast time and afterwards. Thank you. Thank you. This was Sri Ramananda Vaskaswami Maharaj.
Jai Sri Ram.